conspiracies, endless wars, hidden forbidden history, the depopulation agenda, cryptozoology, mystical visions, hidden mysteries, advanced subterranean civilizations, flying saucers, alien abductions, and secret space programs, time travel, wellness, and healthy living. Where do you go to find out about these subjects and more? To James Bartley's Cosmic Switchboard Show. That's where. James Bartley will provide cutting-edge information and will interview the top investigators and researchers in a variety of fields. Listen in every week to the Cosmic Switchboard Show, hosted by James Bartley.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Tom Carey, a native Philadelphian. Tom holds degrees from Temple University, a BS in Business Administration, and California State University, Sacramento, an MA in Anthropology. And he also attended the University of Toronto's PhD program in Anthropology. An Air Force veteran who held a top-secret crypto clearance, Tom is now a retired Philadelphia-area businessman. He has been a Mutual UFO Network State Section Director for Southeastern Pennsylvania from 1986 to 2001, a Special Investigator for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, QFOS, from 1991 to 2001, and a member of the QFOS Board of Directors from 1997 to 2001. Tom began investigating aspects of the Roswell incident in 1991 for the Roswell investigative team of Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, and since 1998 has teamed exclusively with Don Schmidt to continue a proactive investigation of the case. Tom has authored or co-authored more than 40 published articles about the Roswell events of 1947 and has contributed to a number of books on the subject as well. He has appeared as a guest on many radio and TV shows throughout the country, including Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell and George Norrie, Fox and Friends, Comcast Network Friends, and Larry King Live, and has contributed to a number of Roswell-related documentaries on screen and behind the scenes. Tom was a consultant and interviewee on the highly acclaimed and rated 2002 two-hour Sci-Fi Channel documentary, The Roswell Crash, Startling New Evidence, The History Channel's Conspiracy Theory, The Travel Channel's Weird Travels Roswell, The Sci-Fi Channel's Sci-Fi Investigates, and The History Channel's UFO Hunters. He was also a featured interviewee on the 20th Century Fox Golden Anniversary re-release DVD of the 1951 sci-fi classic The Day the Earth Stood Still. 2007, Tom co-authored with Don Schmidt Witness to Roswell, Unmasking the 60-Year Cover-Up, which was the number one best-selling UFO book in the world in 2007 and 2008. Its sequel, Witness to Roswell, Unmasking the Government's Biggest Cover-Up, published 2009, remains a bestseller. Both books are considered to be the best books ever written about the Roswell incident. A recent book about the secret history of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, titled Inside the Real Area 51, also co-authored with Don Schmidt, was released in the fall of 2013 and reached number one in Amazon's Astronomy and Space Science category and was also in its top 100 books of the year in that category for 2013. Another book about Roswell, The Children of Roswell, was released in 2016 and also reached number one in its category on Amazon. A final Roswell book, Roswell, The Verdict of History, is planned for a 2017 release, 70th anniversary of the incident. So without any further ado, Tom Carey, how are you?
Hello, Jim. Nice to be with you.
It's a pleasure. I've really been looking forward to this interview. To me, Roswell is the case that makes the case. It's the case that proves the existence of extraterrestrial life forms on our planet. Could you briefly describe the Roswell incident and how it became the most important UFO case of all time?
Yes, very interesting that when the crash occurred, it was a two-day story back in 1947, and then it went to sleep for the next 31 years. To sort of recap, the modern age of UFOs began 2 weeks earlier in late June of 1947 with the sighting by Kenneth Arnold of 12 crescent-shaped objects flying near Mount Rainier at over 1,000 miles an hour. And that was the beginning of the modern age of UFOs, because when he landed, he reported it, and the press got a hold of it, and they interviewed him, and they asked him to describe what they looked like and how did they travel. And he said, well, they flew as though you threw a plate, a saucer, across a pond, and it skipped across the pond. And thus, someone in the press coined the phrase flying saucer. And that started it all. Well, 2 weeks after that, with sightings occurring all over the world, and especially in the United States, they were front page news in the newspapers. This is before the internet. This is before Facebook. It's, you know, and so the main means of communication were newspapers and radio. And of course, motion pictures, they usually had newsreels. So along about the first week of July, 1947, actually on late in the evening of July the 2nd, there was a thunderstorm north of Roswell. And in between the thunderclaps, some of the ranchers heard a muffled explosion. And the next day, a rancher by the name of Mac Brazel, checking his fence line and to see how his sheep were doing, came across a huge area about a mile long and about 300 feet wide of crash wreckage of little pieces of, you know, that looked like aluminum, but it wasn't aluminum, but it was had the same color as aluminum. And all these pieces, they were either pieces you couldn't bend or pieces that you could wad up like a piece of cellophane and wad it up and then let it go. It would unfurl itself. So he didn't know what to make out of that. So he goes into town in a few days later and into the town of Roswell. He lived near Corona, but the next biggest town was Roswell. Goes to the sheriff's department. You know, I got a bunch of this stuff on my ranch. Who's going to clean this up? And the sheriff, George Wilcox, said, well, what do you think happened? He said, well, something exploded in the sky and came down on my ranch. So Wilcox said, well, anything in the sky is the responsibility of the Air Force. So Roswell just happened to have an air base just south of town where the 509th Bomb Group was stationed. Now, the 509th Bomb Group was our elite military unit at the time. It ended World War II by dropping two atomic bombs on Japan. So after the war, they relocated just south of Roswell. So officer by the name of Jesse Marcel came out and came to the sheriff's office and met Brazel, and he showed him pieces of this wreckage. And he says, well, let me go take a couple pieces back to my commanding officer and I'll get back to you. Well, these pieces of metal were so exotic with strange properties that the commanding officer, William Blanchard, told Marcel, follow that rancher out to his ranch, take somebody with you, and report back what you find. Well, to make a long story short, years later, Marcel said that even before he got back to the base, he suspected that this was one of those flying saucer things. And so he went out to the ranch with another officer, and he spent 2 days there and came back, and they had a meeting. And by that time, they all knew that, hey, at first they thought it was a Russian device. It had to be Russian. But then it wasn't. They realized it wasn't Russian. These strange symbols on it, when the wreckage, were not Russian. No, nobody could make heads or tails out of it. So they went up the chain of command. What do we do? What do we do? Well, they knew that civilians had gotten to the site. They had seen the crash wreckage, and more importantly, some of the civilians had seen these strange little bodies, 3.5 to 4 feet tall, with these large heads, funny eyes, and they definitely were not human. There were 4 dead and 1 still alive. And so they were like, my goodness, what do we do? What do we do? So we believe that the rest of the story was orchestrated by Washington. They first put out a headline on July the 8th, 1947, that the RAAF, that's Roswell Army Air Field, they had come into possession of a flying saucer. And this, once the story hit the newswire, the Associated Press newswire, went around the world. Went around the world, and it just, the whole world was excited. Oh my goodness, tell us more, tell us more. Well, before the day was over, the Air Force retracted the story, and it came out the next day that it wasn't an interplanetary spaceship that the 509th had discovered. It was a common weather balloon. Now, that killed the story dead in the press. The press swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. But you have to think about it. These guys in the 509th, this is our top military unit. You mean they can't tell the difference between an interplanetary spaceship that traveled from another solar system, most likely, and a common weather balloon made out of rubber, tin foil, balsa wood, and baling twine. They couldn't tell the difference. Talk about the big lie, suspension of disbelief. That's the story they went with. Had they gone with a story like it was one of our latest aircraft that we were testing, we have a new alloy that it's made out of, we wouldn't be talking tonight, Jim. We would not be talking tonight. But they went with this cockamamie weather balloon story. Killed the story in the press. They were able to control it within the military, you know, because you have a chain of command, and they threatened all these military people. If you want to talk about it, if you want to learn more about it, you can find out about it in Leavenworth Prison, federal prison. So that shut up the people who were involved in the recovery. But the civilians were another matter. The local civilians in Roswell and Corona, who had gotten out to the site before the military, they knew what they saw was not from this world. Like Jesse Marcel said, it was something that came to the earth but was not from the earth. They knew that. Ranchers were pretty smart, and they were familiar with weather balloons. And so they threatened the civilians with their lives, not only the adults, but the children. They said, if you want to talk about this, we'll kill your whole family. We'll kill your whole family. All this over a weather balloon. Well, the story died right there for the next 31 years, as far as the public knew. But what had happened was that they took all of the wreckage, or most of it, onto Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Same with the bodies, and the live one wound up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And it wasn't until 1978 when Stanton Friedman, another UFO researcher, was in Louisiana giving a talk about his UFOs Are Real talk. Someone suggested that he talk to a fellow who lived in the town of Houma, Louisiana, by the name of Jesse Marcel. Because Jesse claimed to have held pieces of a flying saucer. So before he left Louisiana, Stan Friedman gave him a call, took his story, and thus began, in 1978, the civilian investigation of the Roswell incident. And as I talk to you tonight, we have over 600 first and secondhand witnesses to this event, various aspects of it, from the crash site all the way to the Roswell Army Airfield and on to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We have witnesses all along the trail. We have over 600 of them. And the case for me is the case. Like Paul Newman in the movie The Verdict, he said, this is the case. This is the only case. And so, therefore, I don't investigate other UFO cases. I've only been on this one for the last 25 years, beginning in 1991. And we're still looking for new witnesses. We're still looking for physical evidence. We're contracted for a book due out next year, which will be the 70th anniversary of the event. And everybody's getting on in age. Most of the primary witnesses are gone, and we are now left with mostly the children and grandchildren of the principals involved in the recovery, both military and civilian. So the investigation continues. We've written 4 books on the subject, all bestsellers, and we are going to have another one out next year. And to give you some idea, Jim, of how old this case is now, it's now right on the edge, you know, we're right on the edge of there will be nobody left. You take an airman back in 1947 who for round numbers was, say, 20 years old. Next year, he will be 90 years old. That's how far back this is. Now, there are still some still alive. We are still finding principal witnesses that were there in 1947, but most of them, I'd say 99%, are gone now. And we have spoken to many children and grandchildren. Even some of the children now are passing on. So it's become the granddaddy of all UFO cases because it has everything. We're not talking about lights in the sky. We're not talking about a close encounter, but nothing's left. No physical traces. We're not talking about abductions that don't have anything other than anecdotal stories. We're talking about a crash, an alleged crash that left wreckage and bodies, and there was a cover-up, and we're piercing the cover-up. I've been on this case for the last 25 years, so for me it's like a whodunit mystery, and it's held my interest for that long. And every time we get a new witness or learn something new, it just feels terrific. So for me, it's the endeavor of a lifetime.
What's unique also about Roswell is there's a cast of characters. There's the civilian witnesses, Dee Proctor, Frankie Rowe, Jesse Marcel Jr., the son of Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer. And then you have a whole slew of military witnesses, Colonel Oliver Henderson, who flew some of the bodies to Wright-Patt. You have Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer, Lewis Rickett. It goes on and on. What struck me about Roswell also, Tom, was that there was very much an element of human tragedy to it as well, because some of the lives of the witnesses were absolutely destroyed because of the intimidation meted out to them by the authorities. Can you tell, like, for example, what happened to Sheriff George Wilcox, one of the key witnesses who was claimed in some circles to have seen the alien bodies?
George Wilcox was the sheriff of Chavez County, where Roswell was located. So he was actually the chief law enforcement officer for the county where the base was located. George Wilcox basically rolled over for reasons unknown, maybe because the base contributed mightily to the economy of the town of Roswell. So there was a symbiotic relationship there. And also, Sheriff Wilcox was fluent in Spanish. And what happened was that the rancher had come into his office with two boxes of wreckage. And it was Wilcox who called the base. Now, Wilcox, before he died, he said the biggest mistake he ever made in his life was calling the Air Force, or the Army Air Corps, was as it was called back then, first. He said he should have called the media first, because then if the media got on the story first, it wouldn't have been covered up. It would have been too late to cover up. But he called the Air Corps, Army Air Corps, and they got there before, just soon after the sheriff and the fire department had gotten there, but they took control of everything. And George Wilcox regretted that to the day he died. And he was actually the first key witness to die. He died in 1961 in a mental hospital. And what had happened was the Air Force used him. I'll just refer to the Air Force rather than saying the Army Air Corps all the time. It's the Air Force used him to intimidate the Hispanic, the local Mexican population who had gotten out to the crash site, knew about the bodies, knew about the crash, and they used Wilcox, because he was fluent in Spanish, to threaten them with not only the lives of the adults, but the lives of their children if they didn't keep quiet about this. Again, we're talking about a weather balloon, you know? So Wilcox, he basically acceded to the wishes of the government and the Air Force, and he did this. But on certain occasions, when he knew the party whom he was supposed to intimidate, whom he knew very well, he refused, and they would bring in somebody else, an Air Force officer who was more or less a sort of thuggish. They used a guy named Arthur Philbin and another one by the name of Hunter Penn from Wright-Patterson. They brought in to really intimidate the civilian witnesses and the ranchers. So Wilcox, like I said, he died in 1961, long before we ever heard about this story. But when we got on the case in the late 1980s and early 90s, we interviewed Wilcox's two daughters, Phyllis and Elizabeth. And we said, well, you know, how did the Roswell crash affect your father? And they said it destroyed him. And we're thinking, oh, my goodness, destroyed him? How could, you know, he's a sheriff. He deals with a lot of things. How could something like the Roswell crash destroy him? Because there was as far as we knew back then, it was mostly a military event by the Air Force. And then they told us, they said, well, he had to do certain things. And they didn't tell us exactly what those things were. But we got the full story from Wilcox's granddaughter, Barbara Duggar. See, here's where the grandchildren come in. And she said that her grandfather, George Wilcox, the sheriff, had gotten out to the crash site, had seen the wreckage, and had seen the bodies, and as she called them, the space beings. She called them the space beings. He had seen them, and then the military got there, and they swore everybody to secrecy. Well, when all of the recovery had taken place a few days later, the dust had cleared. Remember now that Mac Brazel, the rancher, had come into town with two boxes of wreckage. He gave one box to Jesse Marcel, who took it to the base and showed his commanding officer, and he left it there. But somewhere along the line, the Air Force found out that there was a second box left at the sheriff's office. So, according to Barbara Duggar, the military showed up at the sheriff's office in Roswell. And so the sheriff, he's saying, oh, boy, they're probably coming here to give me a pat on the back on what a good job I did in threatening all those Mexican witnesses. Well, they come into the office, and they put the sheriff of Chavez County in a hammer lock, shove him up against the wall, and they said, where is it? Okay, where is it? Where's what? Where's the box of wreckage? They wanted the second box of wreckage. So George, he's still in a hammer lock, and so he takes him into the conference room there. And I've been in there, and I actually took a photo of the closet where they kept this box of wreckage. The old sheriff's office is gone now. I mean, it's gone. But I was fortunate enough to get there when it was still there. And so they picked up the second box of wreckage. And the sheriff's family, his wife and his daughter, Phyllis, who was married at the time, still lived there because her husband was in the military. And they heard the ruckus going on downstairs. So down comes George's wife, Inez. And she says, what's going on here? Well, sit down, Mrs. Wilcox, and you too, Sheriff. And they read the riot act to Mr. and Mrs. Wilcox. If you ever talk about this, we will kill you, and we will kill your family, including your children and grandchildren. Now, what kind of thing is that to say to the sheriff of Chavez County, who had helped you out by delivering such a message to local citizens? And in the end, they got the message too. Well, according to Barbara Duggar, that wasn't quite enough, because a few days later, Wilcox got a call from the base, and they wanted to see him again. And so his wife, Inez, says, George, you better take somebody with you. So he took a deputy with him. And he came back a few hours later, and according to Inez, she said it looked like he had been roughed up again. He had a faraway look, you know, they call it the thousand-yard stare. He had this faraway look on his face, and it looked like he had been roughed up. And he never ran for sheriff again. He never ran for sheriff again. And his wife, Inez, said before she died, she believed to her dying day in 1978 that the Air Force had given her husband a shot or something that brought on an early onset of Alzheimer's, which George came down with fairly young. But whether that's true or not, we don't know, but that's what his wife believed. And it turns out that George became very paranoid, wound up with Alzheimer's, attacked his wife, Inez, and that's what put him into a mental hospital where he died a few months later. So the family was devastated, and they probably had the worst experience of anybody, and they did as much as anybody to help the Air Force out. You know, we did find out why the Roswell incident destroyed George Wilcox. We did find that out. And it was because more so the aftermath than actually seeing a crashed flying saucer and little space beings. It was more that the treatment he got from his own government.
Mac Braswell, the rancher, also said to his friends and neighbors that, likewise, the worst thing he ever did was tell the military about what had happened. And like you said, all he wanted to do was find someone to clean up this god-awful mess that was on the property he was managing.
Yes.
Now, there was an interesting incident that happened to Mac Braswell's son, involving a disappearance of Mac Braswell's son. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. Mac Braswell had three sons. We call him Bill Jr., but it was really his one son was named Bill, the other son was named Paul, and the third son was named Vernon. Vernon was only 7 years old at the time. I guess 13 years later, in 1960, Now, Vernon, according to the newspaper, was with Mac Brazel when he found the wreckage. Well, that turned out not to be true, but he was out on the ranch. He was at the ranch house at the time, which was actually 10 miles from the crash site. So he was on this on the ranch, but no, he never got to the crash site that we know of. But he certainly knew what had happened from his father. He was treated badly, too. Mac was sequestered. They went and they found him when they realized that this thing was from outer space. They said, "Where's that rancher? Where's that rancher?" So they found the rancher. They took him onto the base, kept him at their guest house for a week. And they basically read him the Riot Act as well. That if you talk about this, we're going to kill everybody in your family. And also, he retracted his story. His original story was that he had thought he had found perhaps something that he was mentioned in the first story that hit the newspaper, that they found a flying saucer. His name was mentioned, W.W. Brazel. But they got Brazel to recant and then go around to the media in town to recant the story. So he helped them out there. But again, if you talk about this, we're going to kill you and your family. So in 1960, Vernon Brazel is 20 years old. He had, I guess he spent 2 or 3 years in the Navy, something like that. He was out of the Navy. He had a job. He had his own car. And his car was found in Grants, New Mexico, with the engine running, the door open, and Vernon was nowhere to be seen. It's like he dropped off the face of the earth. And he was never seen again by his family. Never heard from again, never seen again. His family never, what happened to Vernon? They never knew. And so they traveled to Grants, and the police department there wouldn't help them. They told them, the family, oh, he died fishing. Now, New Mexico is in a desert area. I don't know what kind of fishing they had there, but they don't have much fishing. How could he die fishing in New Mexico? But that was the story they told them. Well, the family, that was it. You know, they never heard from him again. Mac and his wife, Maggie, his wife's name was Maggie. They moved to Alaska, and that was it. Well, about 3 or 4 years ago, the UFO Museum in Roswell, which is dedicated to the 1947 case, myself and Don Schmidt were speakers there every July at the festival. They received a call from a woman who lived in Montana. She wanted to know, do you know anybody named Brazel? Well, yes, that's the name of the family where the ranch, the flying saucer was found. Well, it turns out that Vernon Brazel went to Montana, left his bank account, left his car, left everything that he owned in New Mexico without a word, went to Montana, got a new name, and married this woman. And in 1967, he committed suicide. And he had this tattoo on his arm with the name Vernon on it. And she said, "Well, who is Vernon?" "Oh, that's one of my uncles." Well, it was his own name. Well, she never knew who he was, other than Vernon, and they had a new last name. Few years ago, she's trying to, you know, she's not working anymore. She's trying to get Social Security, and she used her husband's, I guess, his Social Security number, and up came the name Vernon Brazel. And she said, "Vernon Brazel? That's not my husband's name." Well, they started making inquiries using the name Brazel, and they wound up calling the museum in Roswell. If the name Vernon Brazel meant anything to them, of course it was the missing Brazel son. And so she came down and she met everybody, and now she at least knows who her husband was. But what the story represents is a mystery. Why would you leave your family unless you're under some sort of mental pressure, mental something or other, that you would just leave your former life, go far away under another name, and just sort of pretend you have nothing to do with your real family and wind up committing suicide? So it's one of those real mysteries of the Roswell case. Whatever happened, what did happen to Vernon Brazel? Was it the threats? What was it? We don't know.
What's interesting, Tom, also, if we fast forward to the recent past, we find the late New Mexican Congressman Stephen Schiff pushing the General Accounting Office to dig up anything the GAO has about Roswell. And he was pushing very hard. Suddenly he comes down with cancer and he dies. That's another weird thing about all this.
Especially skin cancer. I didn't know skin cancer was terminal.
Yes.
But apparently it was some really virulent form of skin cancer, which I never heard of. He had taken over a request from he was a congressman from New Mexico. He had, at the request of some of his constituents, he took over a quest to find documents relating to the Roswell incident. He was not trying to solve the Roswell incident. He was trying to locate documents relating to it to see if the documents had been handled within prescribed tenets of storage. Well, what he learned was that all of the documents, we're now talking about teletype messages, telex messages, handwritten, typed documents, anything relating to the Roswell Army Air Field Base and Fort Worth Army Air Field Base and Washington for the time period in question, that several weeks span in early July of 1947. Any document relating within that time span, he wanted to see. Well, it turns out that all of those documents had been destroyed, date unknown, by authority unknown. And I was in the Air Force myself. You can't do anything unless it's authorized. Everything has to be authorized, especially storage and destruction of documents. Everything for that time period was missing. I mean, it sounds familiar to us. You know, we're in the presidential election here and a lot of missing documents. But for Roswell, it's very suspicious that all those documents turned up missing, and we don't know who destroyed them, under what authority, or when they were destroyed. So Stephen Schiff, he wrote a report. He said, and I remember the comments from one of the premier muckraking journalists of the time, Jack Anderson, who was a disciple of Drew Pearson, one of the famous Washington muckrakers of the 1950s. And Jack Anderson took over for him in the 1960s. I remember Jack Anderson writing, we don't know what happened at Roswell, but something big did happen. He was sure of it. But just what that something big was, he didn't offer an explanation. Well, the only explanation we have is a balloon crash. Now, I don't think that's something big. So Stephen Schiff died suddenly thereafter with this skin cancer, which sort of shocked everybody.
It goes back to the whole concept of the human tragedy associated with Roswell. One of the most fascinating stories that I came across was reading your book, Witness to Roswell. you told the story of the New Mexican Lieutenant Governor Joseph Montoya, known as Little Joe. Apparently, Lieutenant Governor Joseph Montoya was at Roswell Army Air Force Base when all this was going on. Could you tell a bit about what he experienced and what happened to him there?
Yes. Little Joe Montoya, in 1946, he ultimately became a U.S. Senator in the 1960s from New Mexico. But in 1947, he was the Lieutenant Governor of New Mexico. And the governor was a fellow by the name of Tom Mabry. Well, Montoya, at the time of this incident, he just happened to be in the right place at the right time. We don't know if it was serendipitous or serendipity that he happened to be in the right place at the right time, or as the highest ranking state official, he was called into the base at that time. We're not sure which it was, but he wound up on the base just when they were bringing in the wreckage from the crash site and the bodies from the crash site. Now, all of that stuff was first taken to a hangar on the base. It's now known as Building 84. It's still there, and it's still an operating hangar. But back in 1947, it was Hangar P, as in Paul, 3. Well, he went over to the big hangar, and whether he was called there or just happened to walk over on his own serendipity, we don't know. But he went inside and saw everything that was being brought in. Well, he had a lot of local young supporters in town. They were called Montoyistas, young supporters, young political supporters of Joseph Montoya, Montoyistas. So he called one of the local Montoyistas and said, get me the hell out of here. Get over here quick. Get me the hell out of here. Well, where are you? Well, I'm on the base. Meet me at the water tower, which is still there. And so these are two fellows. These were the Anaya brothers, Pete and Pete and Ruben Anaya. So they drive over to the base. Pete worked on the base, so they let him in. So he drives over to the big water tower, and there's Joseph Montoya hanging onto the water tower, shaking. He jumps in the car, slams the door shut. Let's get the hell out of here. What's the matter? And he's sitting in the back seat, just rocking back and forth. They weren't human. What wasn't human? The spacemen. And they couldn't make sense out of what he was saying. So they drove him over to Pete Anaya's house. And he says, I need a drink. So they gave him a shot of Jim Beam, and he guzzled that down. He says, no, give me the bottle. And so, according to Pete Anaya, it was glug, 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 glug. He downed the whole bottle of Jim Beam. And then he relaxed and lay down on the sofa, and he told the story of, he called it a plate, a flying saucer plate. And he said it was from the moon. He told him it was from the moon. You wouldn't believe it. And oh, the little bodies. Oh, it was horrible. It was horrible. Horrible. And so then he dropped off to sleep. And so they were describing how he was resting there on the sofa, but he kept twitching as though he was fighting something. He kept twitching. And finally he woke up and said, okay, get me over to the hotel. So they called somebody, a fellow by the name of Red Worley, and another Montoyista, and he drove him over to the Nixon Hotel. Now, we interviewed all those people, the Anayas and Red Worley, and they all, the Yanai brothers swore that this story was true. And I even interviewed Pete Anaya's son, John Anaya, who worked for Joseph Montoya. When Montoya became a senator in Washington, he was one of Montoya's staffers. And I asked John, I said, is this story true? And he said, yes, it is. And I said, how do you know? He says, because when I worked for him, I asked him about it. And Montoya told him, yes, the story's true. But if anyone ever asked me publicly, I will deny it. But the story's true, I'm telling you. So we then interviewed Red Worley, who drove the automobile from the Anaya's house over to the Nixon Hotel. And soon as we mentioned the crash, his hands started shaking. He was drinking coffee. Soon as we mentioned, okay, we understand that you drove the lieutenant governor from Pete Anaya's house, and his lips started quivering and his hands started shaking. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. But he gave us his answer with the way he was behaving, that he knew exactly what we were talking about. So Joseph Montoya is dead. He was a good friend of another senator from New Mexico, Pete Domenici. Pete Domenici is still alive, but he has Alzheimer's and he's beyond being interviewed. So I was going to ask him, did he remember? You know, it's when, if you don't get on something, when a story's this old, unless you get on it right away, you run the risk of them dying or becoming infirm with something like Alzheimer's. And we never did get to Pete Domenici because he's has Alzheimer's now.
One of the witnesses that had since passed away is Frank Kaufman, and I've always been interested in his story. Could you elaborate on what Frank Kaufman experienced and what he reported?
Well, Frank Kaufman was a fellow who, during World War II, he was stationed at the Roswell Army Airfield as a clerk typist. He was in personnel. He was a sergeant. Well, when we learned about him, from Walter Haupt, who was a first lieutenant base public information officer back in 1947. He put out the press release, the original press release about the crash of a flying saucer. And Walter Haupt said we ought to talk to Frank Kaufman because he had overheard Kaufman in various, they were both on the city council for a while, and he knew Kaufman had been telling stories about the crash. And they were, you know, just not a whole lot, but he knew something about the crash, so he told us to Frank Kaufman might be somebody we want to talk to. So he became he became an informer because he said that he became an elite member of an elite unit called the Nine, where they would be called to very high level projects all over the country, all over the world. And I know I first met Frank Kaufman in 1994, and he was passing himself off as at least a full bird colonel at that time. And I'm thinking, this guy is no officer. He does not talk like he was an officer. He talks more like he was a sergeant. And so I never was quite comfortable with him. And he told the story that he was heavily involved in the recovery of this flying saucer that crashed north of Roswell. But the story he told didn't jive with what we were finding out about the crash. For instance, the main crash site that we knew at the time was the one that the rancher Mac Razzle had found up near Corona with all this debris scattered about. Well, Kaufman told us, well, that was a salted site, meaning that the site was a phony site put together to throw us off the trail. I'm thinking, my goodness, that's the biggest site of this whole deal here. It's over a mile long and thousands of pieces of little wreckage, thousands of little pieces of wreckage. That's a salted site just to throw us off, 60 years later. And then he said that they had it all cleaned up the night of the crash, which again didn't follow what other witnesses were telling us. And so he also drove us to another site where he said this is where the ship itself finally wound up. And let me tell you, Jim, it was very, very difficult to get to that site. And I don't see how the fire engines could get out there. You had to cut fence and go across rough terrain in the desert to get there. And I'm thinking, my goodness, I don't see how anybody could get here with large vehicles. And so by this time, we're thinking we think that his story is starting to not add up. So in the last year of his life, which was 2001, I think it was 2001, we finally said, okay, Frank, we don't believe you. Why did you do it? And now, mind you, my co-author had already written a book with a fellow named Kevin Randall in 1994, in which Frank Kaufman was the lead character. I mean, he was the main character in this book they called The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, which turned out to be not the truth. And I didn't have anything to do with that. And so I said, Frank, why did you do it? And he says, well, it got out of control. Because, I mean, everybody was coming out there. I mean, the owner of the land, I mean, he put like a big, he put together a whole scenario for people visiting his ranch to look at the crash site. And we said, this can't be the crash site. This cannot be it. And it turned out not to be the crash site, but it's one that Kaufman picked out of thin air. And so the rancher was charging fees to take people out to the crash site. And we hated to break the news to him that it was a bogus site. So anyway, we said, Frank, why did you do it? I mean, we had CBS out there. We had every, network out there, especially during the 1997 50th anniversary year. He says, well, it got out of control. And then he lost control of it, and he couldn't bring himself to stop everybody's joy at looking at this thing. And by this time he was dying of bone cancer, and he passed away in 2001. And we asked him, well, what's the game plan here? And he says, the government's game plan is to run out the clock like a basketball game. You run out the clock like a football game, until the end of the game when everybody's dead. And now he's gone now 15 years. It's hard to believe. But we're now conflicted as to whether he just was a lone wolf making up these stories, or more likely he was a disinformation guy giving us some real information, but a lot of disinformation to keep us occupied chasing down bogus leads. So that was Frank Kaufman.
Shows the extent, if that was indeed the case, where he was doing this deliberately to throw out false trails, it just shows the lengths that the government will go to keep this covered up, and also at some level reduce it to the level of absurdity. Yeah. By having Frank Kaufman leading people off on a wild goose chase.
Or for a weather balloon.
Now, in the time we got left in the first half, Tom, Could you tell us a bit about the story of Roswell's favorite son, who became an NFL football star and star broadcaster, but who was also there when the 1947 incident occurred?
Yes, yes. This is one of my favorite chapters. About 2008, I was down in Roswell with my wife. I was a speaker again at the museum during the festival. And so we got there a day early, so I'm driving my wife around Roswell to show her what sites there were. And we went over to the New Mexico Military Institute, and they have a football stadium there. And so we got out of the car, and I went to look at the football stadium through the open end of it. And my wife says, so she's looking over somewhere else. She says, Tom, over here, come over here. So I went over. And she said, look at this. And it was a weathered bronze plaque about, I'd say about 2 foot square. And on it were a half a dozen names of football players names I recognized as professional football players. Such as Roger Staubach, who played for the Dallas Cowboys, and a few other names. And they were the names of players who made the National Football League, but who had played at least one game in that stadium when they were in high school. And at the top of the list, and it gave the year that they played in the stadium, at the top of the list was the name of Thomas J. Brookshire, 1949. Well, I knew Tom Brookshire as a star defensive back for the Philadelphia Eagles. Born and raised in Philadelphia, and I saw a lot of Eagles games. I said, Tom Brookshire is from Roswell? Oh my goodness. So this is 2008. I said, I made a mental note that when I get back home, I'm going to call him up. And, so, I did. When I got home, I called, as he had a summer home in New Jersey in Stone Harbor on the coast, and his answering machine kicked in. So I said, I wanted to leave a message that I was guaranteed that he would call me back. And so I said, hey, Tom, my name is Tom Carey. I've been a fan of yours for many years. You were a terrific defensive back for the Eagles. You covered all of the toughest wide receivers that the other teams had, but you had a lot of trouble with this one guy from the Cleveland Browns named Ray Renfro. And I said, please call me back. Well, within 10 minutes, the phone rang. I was upstairs. And I could hear this voice on the phone. It was Tom Brookshire. He said, hey, Carey, you don't know what you're talking about. I could, too, cover Ray Renfro. What game are you watching? So I ran down the stairs and picked up the phone, and we had a nice conversation for at least an hour. He's a great guy, and we reminisced a bit about his career with the Eagles, which ended in 1961 with a unfortunate fracture of his tibia. And he would have been an NFL Hall of Fame player otherwise, but his career ended early with a severe broken leg. But he told me, I asked him about Roswell. He said, yes. I said, do you remember it? He said, yes, I remember it well. He said, I was 16 years old at the time, and I was on summer vacation. My father owned a service station on Main Street in town, and a lot of the servicemen who had automobiles would fill up their automobiles at his father's service station, and he would pump gas. And so he got to know quite a few of the fellows on the base. He said, one thing I remember was that when this happened, it was like an iron curtain went down around the base. The base was closed off to everybody. You couldn't get on. Nobody was coming out. And the only people that were coming in and going out was by air. All ground transportation stopped, and the base was in lockdown. All this for a weather balloon. And so he remembered that distinctly. I said, well, that tracks with what others have told us about the base going into lockdown. So Tom told me about that. And he also told me another story that he was a football player then for the local Roswell High School. And some of his teammates came over to the station one day. Now, this is about a week or so after the incident. Things had died down. And some of his friends came over and said, hey, do you know what Roy Tyner, have you seen what Roy Tyner has? Well, what do you mean? He says, Roy Tyner, who's a welder in town, he has the strangest piece of metal you ever saw. Well, Tom says, well, let's go over and take a look. So Tyner's shop, which is still there. In fact, I took a picture of it just a few months ago when I was down there. It's not a welding shop anymore. It's like an auto parts store. But back in 47, it was Roy Tyner's welding shop. So they walked over to Roy Tyner's welding shop, and so he's welding away there, and he sees the kids, and he puts the torch out and flips up his mask. What do you guys want? We want to see that piece of metal you have. Ah, get out of here. Nope, we're not leaving until you show us that piece of metal. So he walks over to his desk, reaches into a drawer, puts something in his hand and wads it up into a fist. So he walks back over to the boys and he holds his right arm out at shoulder length, pointed towards the boys, and he opens his hand and out floats this ball of something, and it just unfurls by itself and just floats there in the air instead of falling to the ground. And they are just transfixed. They can't believe this. And they say, do that again. So he grabs the piece of metal, wads it up again in his hand, holds it out, opens his hand again, and it unfurls again. It just floats there. They can't believe it. The thing is just floating there instead of falling to the ground. So they said, where did you get that? He says, well, a friend of mine gave it to me a couple of days ago. He was up at a flying saucer that crashed north of town. And he was up there a couple of days ago, picked up this piece, and he gave it to me. Well, the boys had seen enough. And so he says, now get out of here. So they left. And so Tom Brookshire was a firsthand witness to the base closure and to this strange piece of metal that he saw. He also said that, so that also led me to call up Roy Tyner was dead by, Tom Brookshire died. I didn't even know he was sick. Neither did anybody else. He died of gallbladder cancer. In 2010, it was only six months from diagnosis to death. So he had a virulent form of gallbladder cancer that he was dead within 6 months. Nobody knew he was sick. And Tom, as you know, or maybe you don't know, besides being a star football player, he became the CBS Network's main broadcaster for the NFL football game of the week.
With Pat Summerall.
Yeah, with Pat Summerall, correct, in the 1970s. And beginning in the 1980s, he began in Philadelphia the concept of all sports talk radio, 24/7, all sports all the time. Tom Brookshire began that. The show that he started is still on the air, even though he has passed away. And all of that because we saw his name on that placard at the football stadium in Roswell.
That's amazing. Well, we're at the end of the first hour, folks. We're just getting started. You've been listening to Tom Carey talk about the Roswell case. Tom's going to talk about his latest books, Inside the Real Area 51, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, as well as another book called The Children of Roswell. If you like what we do, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, and subscribe and become a member. We will be right back.